Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Brian Ward. I am joined tonight by Angela Y. Zhang and Sydney Engel. Say hi, you two.
Hello.
Hey, y'all.
We are back with another Fables from the Cribside, our show where we review and recap top insights from previous episodes of the show.
Before we get started, we'll remind you a little bit about who we are. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. Usually on this show, we interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Today, instead of a conversation with one expert guest, we're taking a look back at three of our prior episodes with a focus on some common pediatric dermatologic conditions. We're going to be doing our spaced repetition recap of top pearls, this time talking about tinea, eczema, and acne.
I have been itching for this review.
None of you can see the look on Brian's face, but it looks very satisfied.
Like I just scratched a really good itch. Before we jump in, do you want to get started with some picks of the week? Loosen up a bit?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sure, who wants to start?
I will start. My pick of the week is Parent Data, which is unfortunately a subscription-based website, but one that I really love from Emily Oster. It is a website that allows you essentially to search a repertoire of parenting research, kind of similar to evidence-based birth, but more focused on parenting. And there are just a slew of resources on there. And I find it really helpful when I am parenting, but also communicating with families about things, especially some of the things that we don't necessarily learn about in our training. It provides a mechanism to have some sort of evidence to support what you're saying, whether it's potty training or handling interesting behavioral challenges. And it's also a really nice newsletter with just some things that you might not have thought about. So my other pick of the week is using CME money for parenting resources in pediatrics. I was able to get a subscription through that. And I think that that's definitely been a worthwhile resource for my practice in pediatrics.
It's great. You've used it to help children. So CME worthy.
That's what I figure.
Those children may or may not be your own, but
hopefully not just my children, but fair point. All right, who else?
I'll go next. My pick of the week is a New York Times bestselling book by Sherry Dusky Rinker and Tom Lichtenheld. It's been a favorite of multiple members of my family. It is called Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site.
Oh, such a good book.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's really adorable. Is.
I'm bringing it on because it's like a New York Times bestselling book. And I think people are like, what are you reading these days? I'm like, oh, this. There are so many construction trucks and they're so cute and they're like so tucked in. I love the illustration and it rhymes. I hate children's books that don't rhyme.
You know, it's funny you say that because I feel like that's something that I have come to appreciate only now as a parent. That like, if you're going to be reading it 70 times a day, the rhymes really do make a difference.
Or at least make it not rhyme, but be incredibly meaningful, like The Giving Tree.
Fair.
I feel this realm of children's books is something that I have not yet been exposed to, but I didn't know there was a New York Times bestseller list for cardboard picture books.
Well, when you put it that way,
well, the lovely story. You know, I love the visual parts of it, and I love that there's a list for it.
It's art. Angela, what is your pick of the week?
Well, my pick is definitely not as intellectual as yours. It's actually much more practical, and it is to always bring your extra key fob with you to your car, because I am currently stranded in Central Washington at one of my jobs. And we lost our key fob, and turns out it's really expensive to replace these fancy key fobs that can like remote unlock your car and, you know, have all of those things. And they're really hard to come by. So we have been troubleshooting for the last couple of days, and if we had just brought the other key, we could have avoided all of this. So that is my tip. You might look at it and say, I don't need a second copy. We have one copy of the key. And you should ignore that impulse and bring it.
Angela, I feel like this really emphasizes your commitment to the Cribsiders, that you are stranded in, you know, some random place without a car, without anything. And you're like, I am still going to record this recap. So thank you for being here.
I was so stoked to spend time with you too, you know?
Recapping from an undisclosed location. Well, let's transition to the episode. Before we jump too far into each specific topic, I'd like to address one thing real quickly. When discussing presentation of derm conditions in various skin types, there are a few points that we like to clarify before going into the specific pearls. Skin diseases can manifest in all skin types, making it crucial to examine a range of pigment and hair types to avoid misdiagnoses, as our guests really well emphasized. But being aware is not the same as attributing prevalence or severity of dermatologic conditions to race and ethnicity. In these episodes, we talked a lot about different presentations and different races and ethnicities. Race is a social construct and not bound by genetics, but the research about race in medicine has a ton of historical baggage and frankly has a lot of racism. Additionally, social determinants of health, such as access to primary care, affordability and access to prescriptions, and a lot of other factors significantly impact the prevalence of all diseases, not just derm diseases. Recognizing derm findings in different skin tones is an incredibly important skill to have as a physician or as a medical practitioner. Given the long history of race in medicine, it'll take some time to unravel the complexities we've been taught. We appreciate your patience as the Cribsiders team as a whole strives to combat racism in medicine.
Let's be honest. No one starts a business for the joy of calculating tax withholdings. That's where Gusto comes in, to take the stress out of payroll, benefits, and HR so you can focus on why you started your business in the first place. Now, speaking from my own experience, when you're running a small business, the admin tasks pile up fast. Onboarding, paperwork, it all takes time. And when you're also busy working in the hospital, that time is something you just don't have. That's why Gusto is such a game changer. Gusto is online payroll and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. They make things simple. Automatic payroll, tax filing, direct deposits, health and commuter benefits, even 401k plans. Gusto has it all. Gusto has options for nearly every budget, including unlimited payroll runs for one monthly price. No hidden fees, no surprises. So if you're like me and you want to spend less time drowning in paperwork and more time focusing on the work that really matters, give Gusto a try. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/cribsiders and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/cribsiders. One more time, gusto.com/cribsiders.
With that, I feel like we should just jump right in to the first recap, which is tinea.
Let's do it.
Awesome. Well, tinea was episode 82. It was produced by Sydney Angle. Hey, I know her. It was produced by Sydney Angle with guest Dr. Craig Rohan.
So, Brian, what can you tell us about tinea?
Well, I'll teach you what you already taught us, Sydney. Tinea is this super common superficial infection caused by dermatophytes. Now, we learned that dermatophytes are not yeast. Tinea is also known as ringworm and is something that I think a lot of us have seen in the clinic. One of the early and often emphasized points from this episode is that we've all seen it, but how many of us have sent a culture? Dr. Rohan emphasized a low threshold to send a culture, lower than I realized personally.
It was definitely very humbling for me as someone who admittedly has never sent a tinea culture. Even after producing this episode, I feel like I am a little bit embarrassed to ask other people in my clinic how exactly I do it. But maybe now after this recap, I really will. But even if you don't send a culture, I loved his tip that if you can't get a flake off of it to culture, that should make you think a little bit differently about the diagnosis in the first place. If it's so smooth and the scales can't be removed, that may suggest that there's something else that you're dealing with.
So to refresh our memory, to send a culture, Dr. Rohan said you can really put it in anything that's typically sent for a bacterial culture. So you can scrape some off and put it in a urine cup, or you can do a bacterial swab if you can get flakes. We'll talk a little bit more after treatment about what it could be if it's not flaky and what our differential diagnosis is. But once we've made the diagnosis of tinea, either by clinical exam or if you're a little bit confused or need some help by culture, there are two different ways to do treatment. We can do topical treatment or we can do systemic treatment. Dr. Rohan emphasized ketoconazole as one of his favorites for topical treatment. He said it's like a beta-lactam of the fungicidals because it punches holes in cell walls. It also has an added benefit of what's called 5-lipoxygenase, or a sort of an anti-inflammatory effect. And then it's a medication that can be used for quite some time. And so you can use it 2 to 3 weeks after clearance of the tinea. And then we talked a little bit on the episode about how there's minimal risk of resistance. The resistance is usually from inherent funguses or inherent yeasts rather, like Candida. But if you send a large tube home with a family and say, hey, use this until it's gone, and then use it 2 weeks after, and then use it again if the tinea pops up, you're not really risking too much resistance of fungus or of tinea.
I really appreciated that, Pearl, because I feel like I'm always so anxious that I'm going to cause harm by prescribing a treatment. So it's really nice to know that this is something that is, in the grand scheme of things, a fairly benign thing to do. And I think with that in mind, he did provide, of course, recommendation that we do the culture, but if you're waiting for the culture, the diagnosis is uncertain just based on appearance, a reasonable approach to do would be, if you're leaning tinea but uncertain, start ketoconazole twice daily for 2 to 3 weeks. Wait for your results if you do a culture. But if it doesn't improve after 2 to 3 weeks, he would suggest you still use the ketoconazole, in part because of those anti-inflammatory effects, and then also add a mid-potency topical steroid. And I feel like I'm constantly looking for the, like, okay, what do I do when something just doesn't clearly fit a diagnosis? And this was incredibly practical to me. And then he made the point that, like, okay, if it's not responding to either of those two things, that's really at the point where you should involve a dermatological consult if available.
But I love that. I want to be thinking about my diagnoses, and I want to have mindful consults to really ask strong questions, both in the inpatient and the outpatient side, you know. Some of the other things that we can use topically for tinea include terbinafine, but terbinafine has some holes in the spectrum. Selenium sulfide is sometimes used for tinea versicolor, though Dr. Rohan didn't like it that much.
I thought it was so interesting that he described selenium sulfide as, like, it's just not fungicidal. It doesn't kill the fungi, but it makes the yeast slippery, and that's how it works, which is just kind of like an interesting fun fact. But also provides a really nice visual of, like, what you're doing when you use that medication.
The azoles seem to be the backbone of this one also. So fluconazole and itraconazole were recommended. And then there's apparently no such thing as IV ketoconazole or systemic ketoconazole.
You know, I really feel like, well, first, the antifungals are this entire new world of, you know, drugs that I feel like was really helpful to learn about this episode. And then what I love about, honestly, listening to our guests is that not only do they teach us the medical recap, they also give us these practical tips that are what in the end might practically help a family succeed in their treatment. So specifically for the systemic treatments that Dr. Rohan recommended, taking the pill and then exercising or sweating and then not showering after for like many hours so that the azole is secreted into the follicle and actually can penetrate, which I never would have thought of that. That was a really cool tip, even though it might result in maybe some more sweaty and smelly teenagers.
I thought that was so funny. The words he used was wallow in sweat, which I identify with post-run. He talked about that specifically for tinea versicolor, which is often related to kind of humidity. The azoles do have a risk for liver failure and idiosyncratic liver failure, which he brought up and really scared us, especially oral ketoconazole that I mentioned is really not used anymore. But Sydney, what did we learn about that?
Yeah, I mean, so he talked about these risks, right? But then when we asked about, okay, so should you be monitoring baseline labs? Should you be monitoring periodic labs? His general thought was like, lab monitoring, there's evidence that kind of goes multiple directions in terms of the utility of it. We always hate pricking kids if we don't need to. His recommendation is usually like, if you're using it for several months, throw on an AST or ALT, but otherwise probably you can get away without doing the liver enzymes because you're just unlikely to identify anything of clinical utility with that.
I need to do a bit of a deeper dive into this, and I love livertox.com. It's an NIH or livertox. I don't know. There's an NIH website for liver toxicity, but this felt like azoles can cause idiosyncratic liver failure in the same way that walking around in the world could cause idiosyncratic liver failure. It seems like he mentioned that and then felt like retracting it a little bit. Mentioning the liver, though, azoles are cytochrome P450 inhibitors, meaning they will increase the activity of other drugs metabolized by the CYP pathway. And so this is really important in thinking about how many kids we take care of in our clinics who are on other medications for other diseases who have medical complexities. Then, similar to what Angela mentioned about some of the creative ways to prescribe, it can be used, or fluconazole can be used as a pulsed therapy. So give for 2 weeks and then a week off and then a week on and then a week off and then a week on and then maybe two more of the week on, week off, because it will extend the effect of the fluconazole, which I thought was interesting and something I had never done. I think that would take, it would take me and the family having one, an open line of communication, and two, really good therapeutic alliance, knowing that, you know, we're going to write this on a calendar together and make sure that this is done. And three, honestly, probably talking to the pharmacy and making sure that that signature is correct when I send it down.
You know, I heard you mention the azoles, but I don't think we've talked about riseofulvin, which I know I'm probably butchering how it's pronounced, come to think of it, but I know is another one that I've seen used.
Griseofluvin, you mentioned?
Is it really griseofluvin?
I'm not sure. Wait.
Griseofulvin.
Oh my goodness. No? I don't know. And the funny thing is, Sydney, your audio cut out for me like right when you mentioned it.
Oh, that's really funny.
So I'm just going in dark. The one that starts with the G has a little bit less med interactions. It does produce some photosensitivity and can produce some headaches. We didn't talk too much about it, but it is often the mainstay for tinea capitis or hair. It seems like that's our second line. And then third line, or also some specific indications, terbinafine works well for nails when given systemically. Again, I think this just has to do with how it's excreted or where it goes in the body.
Something else that I thought was really interesting also is, you know, in addition to treating your patient, you know, yeast and fungi are infectious organisms. And so treating close contacts. And then he also mentioned pets, which I feel like I'll look at my dog differently from now on. I kind of didn't realize they could be reservoirs for this.
I've got a vet appointment next week. I'll ask them about if they've ever treated pets for tinea for their human owners. Before we jump away from tinea, I want to wrap this up with a discussion of the differential diagnosis. I think oftentimes we'll make a presumptive diagnosis, but it's helpful if we have a few other things in our minds, especially, you know, what if the patient comes back and this hasn't gotten better? The one that I think we see a lot is nummular eczema, which is circle, flaky sometimes, itchy. It's honestly, we had a hard time during the episode, and me doing some background research had a hard time figuring out how to distinguish the difference between the two. We'll talk more about the minor criteria for eczema in the next recap. So I'll just put a plug for continuing to listen to the episode.
Don't go away now.
Don't touch that clicker. Psoriasis was also on the differential. It's also incredibly flaky because of the kind of hyperkeratinizing, actually pathogenesis of psoriasis. It's usually for a little bit older patients, so usually on the adult side. But every adult started out as a child, and every illness has a first presentation. So psoriasis being on the differential for older patients. The one that was a big learning point for me, though, was granuloma annulare. This is an immune reaction with the microscopic finding of, quote, palisading macrophages for all of you test takers out there. And it's, unlike tinea, usually smooth.
You know, this was all over my board's prep, which I can say because it was the study materials, and it made it just seem like it was super common. I don't know if any of you have seen it in clinic. I certainly have never seen it, so it would be helpful.
You know, the episode made me wonder if I have seen it, but have misdiagnosed it, to be honest.
100%. That was what I was going to say, is like, well, maybe if I'd been sending those cultures, then I would have a better idea of if I'd seen it. I will report back now that I'm sending cultures more frequently on whether I am actually seeing this diagnosis or not. The one other differential, which I think is actually a really nice segue into our next topic episode, is just to watch out for tinea incognito, which is, I guess, not really a differential diagnosis. It is a tinea infection, but when you have a tinea infection that is treated with topical steroids, it can make it have an atypical appearance. He described it as almost having like more of like a cauliflower-like appearance or less distinct margins. So again, just kind of something to look out for, or when you see something that just doesn't fit your typical picture of tinea but isn't responding to topical steroids, to have in mind. But maybe we move on to that, from that to talking about something where we do use topical steroids.
I love the tinea incognito. I can transition us with an ill-placed joke. What do you call spaghetti in a disguise?
I really don't know. Angela's thinking about it.
An impasta.
Well, you know, there's that other yeast that looks, you know, it's like classic spaghetti and meatballs or whatever. And I was like, right. No, it can't be that.
Well, let's jump into eczema then.
All right. So for eczema, we actually had the same guest back. There's a lot of overlap between this and tinea that I think were really helpful to listen to the two episodes back to back. And I think we'll try to highlight some of those here. Just unrelated to the eczema, love that Dr. Ron was a fellow bike to worker, which was exciting as somebody who bike commutes. I think first we talked about, you know, onset of eczema. So this is by far and away, I feel like, one of the most common things I saw in my clinic in residency, and I'm sure many pediatricians can empathize with that. And it was really, really helpful to walk through all of the details of this. And so the first thing we talked about was, when do you start seeing eczema? And one thing I thought was really interesting was, it really doesn't start until about 2 months of age. If you see flaky skin findings in a newborn, probably more likely be seborrheic dermatitis or cradle cap, which is in itself sometimes a predisposing factor to eczema, but in itself is not eczema. Or maybe you start to see like milk protein allergy, and we'll talk about how allergies interplay with eczema, but those are things you would see in the more newborn period. And Dr. Ron talked about these kind of like different spikes during the lifetime in terms of when somebody first starts experiencing eczema. So classically, I think you see it in the 2 to 6 month range. And then again, when somebody is a toddler, and in these two age ranges, they're more likely to outgrow eczema than not have it later in their life. Whereas some people present in middle and high school, so that those adolescent years, and those are more likely to be people who have, you know, more lifelong struggles with eczema.
One other, I guess it's a pearl, although it doesn't have a ton of clinical application, is he made the distinction between eczema and atopic dermatitis. And he pointed out that eczema really is a term that just means abnormal skin. So it's incredibly nonspecific. It's a synonym for dermatitis, whereas atopic dermatitis would be the combination of those specific skin findings and the criteria, the specific diagnostic criteria for atopic dermatitis. Not that I think that that really should change our approach, but I appreciated the kind of nuance of the language there.
Yeah, definitely. That was really interesting. Something that was really helpful was to actually be the diagnostic criteria for eczema. I feel like, yeah, this is something you see in clinic, and it just, for me, it's like, this really feels like eczema. Let's try a steroid. And so it's nice to say, okay, here's what I'm actually looking for when I'm looking at a patient. So the first one is that they have an expected classical eczematous rash, which I guess, now that I'm saying out loud, is not maybe super helpful.
I thought this one was so funny. And Dr. Rohan did too. It's just like, if it's eczema, it should look like eczema. Highlights the importance of repetition and seeing these again and again. And if you're confused, I can't tell you the amount of times I've pulled an attending into a room and been like, hey, can you look this weird rash with me? And they're like, Brian, it's eczema again. but reps, you got to have your reps.
I know. It could always be eczema. You know, I feel like that's the tagline. Something that might help you determine if it is eczematous is some of the characteristics would be that the rash is usually bilateral. It's usually symmetric, and then it's waxing and waning. So it's not always there. And that it is itchy or pruritic. And then the third diagnostic criteria is that there's usually a family history. And so sometimes they will test kids for a mutation called the proflagrin mutation, which is an autosomal dominant gene that I think encodes the lipids within your skin barrier. And so, you know, we often tell patients that eczema is a disrupted skin barrier. And so that is what is disrupted in this disease. I think what was interesting about that is, although eczema runs very closely with our other allergic conditions, in and itself is kind of not an allergic condition, right? It's this mutation. And so things like IgE testing or things like skin prick testing or patch testing, I think case by case, probably managed by a dermatologist, but they're not always super useful in your run-of-the-mill eczema.
I feel like that's a good opportunity to plug our recent allergy episode, which I think provided some really helpful tips there. I often have family members asking about IgE testing or allergy testing to figure out the triggers of the eczema, and it's such a hard question to address because obviously you want the family to be able to do everything they can to prevent these the eczema outbreaks, but it's not that simple.
Yeah, totally. And I think, again, it's super confusing because it does run with things like food allergies, with things like asthma. And, you know, we call it the atopic triad or the allergic triad. I often see that in thinking about viral wheeze versus asthma, but he talked a little bit about the fact that there's this atopic march, the progression of disease. So you have food allergies and then maybe you develop eczema and then you develop wheezing or allergic rhinitis afterwards. And so I can totally see how families and even, you know, providers might think about allergy testing for something like eczema. But the takeaway was generally not useful.
So if we're not testing for IgE or, you know, not sending the kind of, let's send a whole panel for food allergies, what are some other things that can help us make the diagnosis of eczema?
So Dr. Rohan also talked about minor criteria, and this was new to me. I really enjoyed learning about this, and, you know, I haven't had the chance to apply it clinically yet, but he talked about several minor criteria. The first was hyperlinear palms, so extra creases on your palms. And he talked about, like, showing a patient their palms or family's palms versus yours and looking at the relative number of creases on there. Even things like anterior cataracts in the eye. And then some things that might be more common and that you might associate more with eczema, like intolerance to fabrics like wool, having these like really exaggerated responses to bug bites, and then an intolerance to perfume or scents. And these minor criteria aren't necessarily to help with diagnosis of eczema, but they help you think about, hey, what comorbidities might my patient have? How severe do I think the eczema is going to be?
I also think it's a reminder that this is a systemic disease. It's a reminder that this affects the whole patient. And it's a fun way to kind of try to treat your patient as a whole. I've been trying to look at my patient's hands, and there's something almost intimate about taking a patient's hand in your hand and looking for those hyperlinear palms. It's very interesting. If you start looking for it, you might find it.
Have you seen it now that you started looking?
I've seen it on like one patient, but that one patient had the worst eczema I've ever seen.
You didn't need the hyperlinear palms to make the diagnosis.
No. Meanwhile, he's like scratching at his legs. I mean, can I have my hand back?
Speaking of that, one thing that I really appreciate in this episode is that, you know, this validation that like the itchiness and pruritus is in itself like such a debilitating condition, symptom, and that you should have a really low bar, right, to treat it as eczema or to refer to dermatology. And I definitely agree that itching is one of those things that we aren't really able to capture as a severe, like the severity of itching in a patient, but it can totally affect somebody's quality of life. So I appreciate that, Pearl. Additionally, as a throwback to our Tinia episode that we just recapped, Dr. Ron talked about misdiagnosing the two or confusing them with each other and how the treatment for eczema might actually affect diagnosis of Tinia. So in this example, if somebody has a rash and you think it's eczema, so you ask them to put emollients on it or put steroids on it, but it actually is Tinia, the emollients can make the Tinia look worse or different or just not characteristic. And then the steroids can also make the appearance of Tinia look different and thus make it harder to then finally diagnose. And so thought that was interesting about the interplay there.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners. Today, we're going to talk about Claude from Anthropic. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you, not for you. Whether you're tackling a complex project or just trying to get a little more space back in your day, Claude helps extend your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. And if you've been listening to us for a while, you know we've been discussing how AI is shaping medicine. In fact, in episode 135, we dove deep into how we use AI in large language models in pediatric medicine, both the ways to improve efficiency at work and the guardrails we must put in place. That conversation really showed us just how powerful these tools can be. And of course, not all of our AI use is serious. Chris has been using Claude to make original AI poems at the end of each episode, so stay tuned to the end for this one. But beyond that, Claude goes much deeper than your average AI. It can analyze complex research, surface insights across tons of sources, and even connect with your professional tools like Google Workspace or Notion, so everything's in one place. It's not about shortcuts, it's about thinking better and more creatively. So, Cribsiders listeners, are you ready to tackle bigger problems? Sign up for Claude today and get 50% off Claude Pro when you use our link, claude.ai/cribsiders. That's claude.ai/cribsiders right now for 50% off your first 3 months of Claude Pro. That includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. It's claude.ai/cribsiders.
In the next part of the episode, we talked a lot about how eczema might present on different people. So briefly, we mentioned different types of eczema in different races and ethnicities. We talked at the beginning of the episode how those might not be the most accurate categories because race is social, not biologic. And Dr. Braun himself even said that he has patients that don't fit into those, you know, this ethnicity equals like this type of eczema bucket. And so I think the takeaway is like anybody can experience anything and you should be looking for all these different types, right? Like popliteal fossa eczema, nummular on the cheeks, or more papular eczema in all your patients, regardless of their self-identified race or ethnicity. Something that I do think is really important to keep in mind though, is that the way that eczema appears on skin might be different depending on how pigmented the skin is or the skin type. And so learning how these appear on skin of color is something really important. And that there are inequities here, right? A Black patient might have more severe eczema, not because they're Black, but because there are all of these determinants of health that we talked about, structural inequities, environmental pollutants, things like that, that might worsen it. So it's important to recognize that there are differences, but attribute them accurately. I want to move on to treatment next, if we are ready to do that.
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Awesome. So a lot of these, I really liked how Dr. Rohan was empowering PCPs to do a lot of these. And we'll talk about kind of where you should take a pause and consult dermatology. The first line, you know, let's say you have an infant with eczema 2 to 6 months old, you might use an emollient. And the takeaway is there are many different brands and ingredients out there. And I don't think he has a favorite per se, but really just to avoid preservatives, fragrances, scents. For instance, even in some diaper wipes, there are preservatives that make it feel, I think he said, make them feel fancy. And you should avoid those because those can actually cause contact dermatitis. So being really mindful of the ingredient lists and consulting with your doctor or derm about, you know, which ingredients to really look for. He talked about some practical tips. He mentioned sometimes if parents buy the tube of emollient, they like squeeze onto a finger and then it's really hard to spread evenly. So he talked about getting a jar and then really just tapping a couple fingers to it and then putting it on the skin one fingertip at a time. And I think those kinds of things are what help parents, you know, feel less frustrated with the medication they're trying to administer. And then interestingly, making sure their baby's fingernails and I guess your own fingernails are not sharp and further disrupt the skin.
I think the quote he used is taking steak knives and bringing them down to butter knives. It's been one of my favorite things to do, to clip the little fingernails in my household.
Yeah, I mean, those fingernails can be quite sharp, so it's definitely something to keep in mind. They can be sneaky.
They'll get you.
If you feel like emollients aren't working, then you can move to a really low potency. So in this case, class 5 to 6, the higher the number, the lower the potency. You can start with a low potency steroid. And then, of course, if there is concern for superinfection, as is common in eczema, then you would use something like bupirocin.
Another throwback to the tinea was that fact that the skin barrier in eczema is broken down in atopic dermatitis. And so it's more likely for patients with eczema to get things like impetigo or tinea or eczema coxacium or things like that. I've seen some pretty bad eczema super infections, and it's because the atopic dermatitis will break down the skin barrier that's so good at keeping infections out.
Yeah. And then I feel like it's this vicious cycle because the superinfection hurts or itches and they further damage the barrier. So super important to try to get to the source of it.
It was helpful for me to know that it's not a bad thing to do bupirocin as well as steroids kind of at the same time.
Yeah, good call out. Another thing he talked about is the quote soak and seal method, or using wet wraps or wet to dry. So things like putting on 2 layers of fabric. So you would put a onesie or gloves or socks or whatever fabric you're trying to use into water, wring it out so it's damp but not soaking, and then put another dry layer of the same item of clothing on. I will just quickly say that I did this once. I don't have eczema, but I had really dry hands. And so somebody recommended I do this with gloves, which is why I know every single step. And it was like, it was pretty uncomfortable. And I ended up taking them off in my sleep and like throwing them across the room. So I will say but it was really effective when I managed to keep them on. So I can speak to the efficacy.
I appreciate that, because I was going to say, I always struggle with talking to parents about this. I almost leave this as a conversation for derm, because I just know how hard it is to like wriggle your child into a onesie as it is, much less a wet onesie. And so I'm always like, oh my goodness, if it's not something I would want to do to my child myself, how can I recommend it to people? So maybe it's more of a like, listen, this is hard, but it's very effective, is kind of the messaging around it. One other intervention he talked about that I have over time gotten more comfortable with is the idea of doing bleach baths. And he described it, the concentration he typically uses, a full bathtub of water with 1 capful of household strength bleach, which he made the point is a similar concentration to pool water. I have not double checked that, but regardless, I think it is a nice way of framing it to parents, because I definitely have gotten some stares and they're like, you want me to put bleach on my child? So just kind of like normalizing that as an intervention that does seem to help at least reduce the risk for superinfection or superimposed infection.
And then for parents who aren't comfortable with the bleach, the salt water trick, using kind of almost seawater consistency, salt water in the bath, is similarly has similar efficacy as a bleach bath for those who want to completely stay away from bleach.
Yeah. So if, none of those are working in your patient, I think it's time to address the more prescription strength hydrocortisone steroid creams. And I think there's so many strengths out there and so many names, but we'll kind of focus on some broad strokes. One of the main things to keep in mind is that there is tachyphylaxis when it comes to steroids. So you get diminishing returns of the efficacy, but you still will get the side effects of the medication. So we'll talk about the regimen that will ensure that you're getting the most efficacy with the most safety of steroids. I think this is also really important to go over these prescription directions with parents, because, and I've seen this on social media, there's a lot of I think negative feelings or like misinformation about steroid creams and steroid therapies for eczema. And so I think just partnering with families to make sure that we know how to use them efficaciously and safely. So the most important thing is, because you get this diminishing returns, it's not something that you're going to use continuously until the eczema gets better, unlike put up before with the oral therapies for tinea, right? So in this, it's really important to do like 2 weeks on, 1 week off, or 5 days on, 2 days off. I think you can pick really any cadence that works for your families, but the important thing is that the breaks in the middle are what help the steroid kind of reset the effect on the skin. And then you might want to take a shorter, you know, you might want to do fewer days on, more days off. You're thinking about thinner skin, like face, genital area, the axilla, and areas like that.
Yeah, I found that so helpful just in terms of like, rather than framing it in a specific amount of time, just talking to the family about this tachyphylaxis and the importance of that you're going to have greater efficacy if you're taking breaks. So I have utilized that a lot in conversations with families. Another thing that I found helpful in the conversation was just talking about quantities, because this is my perpetual nemesis when I am putting an order in, is like, how much cream does this kid really need? So obviously it's not a perfect science, but he gave a couple of rules of thumb. One is that if you are in a kid with pretty generalized eczema in a baby, a 60-gram tube you can expect to last for 1 to 3 weeks. And so that's a pretty reasonable prescription, especially if you're taking those breaks on a monthly basis in that case. Well, hopefully you aren't needing it that frequently, but kind of don't start with the 15-gram tube for a kid that has eczema over their whole body was kind of what I took away from that. And then the 15-gram tube is much more helpful if it's like an eyelids or just like kind of some smaller patches. And then he did say that if you're prescribing for teens, it may be very reasonable to do some of the higher quantities, the ones that come in jars, the 180 or 240 grams.
This is such a real struggle that I have when I prescribe. So this was very helpful, because it also helps you say like they need this amount and help also justify it to insurance and things like that, you know? So I really loved that tip.
Fall always feels like a reset. Between busier schedules and shorter days, finding the time to cook can be really tough. That's why I use Factor. Factor makes it easy to eat well without the stress of meal prep. Their meals are chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. For me, that's huge. I often don't have much time in the hospital, and Factor lets me skip the chopping, cooking, and cleanup while still eating something satisfying. I also love their vegetarian meals, especially the pastas. They're comforting, filling, honestly some of my go-tos when I need something fast but delicious. Factor also gives you more variety each week, from Mediterranean diet meals to GLP-1-friendly options and even premium seafood like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. And now you can try new bold global flavors too. No matter your routine, you'll find something that works. And with Factor, you can save time, eat well, and actually look forward to your meals, even on the busiest days. So here's the deal. Eat smart at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase.
I want to talk briefly about some of the side effects of steroids. You know, we can't cover all of them, but one of the ones we talked about is actually contact dermatitis from the medication. So, you know, kind of paradoxically, it can make the condition look worse on your skin. So using steroids over exposed or damaged skin can create contact dermatitis. There are these different categories of allergenicity, which we won't get too much into, but things that are, for instance, the steroids that are most allergenic are like Pred, Hydrocort, Triamcinolone. And so something that might be useful is to do a little patch test and see if there is a contact reaction. And because it's a late hypersensitivity reaction, it won't occur until a couple of days after. So same type of reaction as like poison ivy, contact dermatitis. And then families can do this at home as well. All of these things that we just talked about, Dr. Rowan actually feels like is within the realm of a PCP. You're obviously always welcome to consult derm if they're at your institution. But I think that it's nice to know like that there are actually quite a lot of options to manage eczema until you have to go to a specialty. Some of the rules of thumb he uses are, you know, always start with the weakest topical steroid, especially in babies. They have more absorption. And so just really being careful with the dosage there and trying to avoid it near the eyes in them. And then probably where he would consider referring dermatology is once you get to a class 3 steroid. So triamcinolone, for instance, probably the maximum strength you'd recommend for a PCP to manage, unless, you know, before talking to a dermatologist. And then, you know, anything above like class one steroids, tacrolimus, PDE inhibitors, I think you should definitely be talking to your dermatologist, although he feels that after consultation, a PCP can be managed tacrolimus, which was a cool little fact. And then there are these other, you know, more advanced treatments for more refractory eczema that definitely should be in the specialty realm. So things like narrowband phototherapy, and then things like methotrexate, azathioprine, MMF, cyclosporin, and then even biologics. And then, of course, yeah, you're moving into a lot more systemic medication, a lot more systemic side effects.
Yeah, I think some of this is interesting. And again, pointing to the fact that this is an atopic march and this is a whole body disease. So things like the biologics, like dupilumab is an IL-4 and IL-13 inhibitor, and it's helpful with asthma as well as eczema and other things on the atopic march. I do think I'm going to get more comfortable with prescribing a topical calcineurin inhibitor. I think that's something that I will, not to overuse the term, but I'm going to curbside one of our dermatologists at in Cadillac, Tennessee, and discuss, hey, would you feel comfortable with me doing this? Because I've heard some things about it. I have yet to prescribe a topical calcineurin inhibitor, but it's on my bucket list. Well, with that fantastic discussion, I think we should break out of these two episodes and jump right into acne.
Really slipped that one in there.
I know. I was going to say that was so subtle, I almost didn't catch it, but good job.
I'm slippery like selenium sulfide. That's it.
Oh, you're good. All right. So the last episode we're going to recap for today is episode 95 on acne. Our guest for this episode was Dr. Brandi Kennerbell, produced by Dr. Clara Mao. So just kind of starting with the diagnosis and classification of acne. Acne is classified by age of onset. So there is obviously infantile acne, and then there's very common to have adolescent acne. She highlighted that the real area of concern is if you do see acne with an onset in mid-childhood. So they didn't have it as an infant, but then the first time they experience acne is between, let's say, ages 2 to 7, which is indicative of an endocrine issue and does warrant a full workup.
This was a huge throwback to our endo episode. I felt like it was really fun thinking about what this workup would look like, including a bone age or other things like an LH, FSH, free and total testosterone, DHEAS. As an expert opinion, Dr. Kennerbell mentioned, maybe just start with the bone age and see where that gets you. Because what you don't want to miss is precocious puberty.
Exactly. And so it's kind of it's an interesting one because it's never the first symptom that or first sign that I look for. And I think that this will make me a little bit more wary of it. And then what else you should be evaluating that might come along with that. The other, again, so we're talking about classification, which is by age of onset. The only other area where she's like, okay, this warrants kind of immediate referral, immediate evaluation, is when you have a infant with very severe acne. So that, again, and that typically presents between 6 weeks and 1 year. Having infantile acne in and of itself is non-concerning.
Just one quick thing that I thought was interesting was she was like, oh, like if they only have pustules, they don't have neonatal acne, they have to have comedones. It reminds me of how dermatologists like hate the word maculopapular. You know, they're so specific. And I feel like I have not been looking for, is this a comedone or is this a pustule when I look at, you know, baby acne. So it was just a good reminder of there are several different types of findings in these conditions.
And a throwback to that differential diagnosis of, is it neonatal pustular melanosis, something that one of those newborn rashes that's, oh, this is interesting, I have a name for it, we're also going to do nothing about this.
That's a lot of newborn rashes. And I always wonder how much time I should put into making sure that I diagnose it correctly when in the end of the day, it's that management is the same. But we're getting totally off topic.
for acne specifically, though, what else is on the differential diagnosis?
Yeah, so not as much when you're talking about the infantile, but in general, the differential diagnosis that you would be looking for is folliculitis, impetigo, and HSV. There's obviously other ones, but those are kind of the big ones that she pointed out that you should be aware of. The other point that she made when talking about kind of the classification and diagnosis is that acne can be thought of almost like a metabolic syndrome of the face. And I had never heard this before. I haven't heard it since. But I do think it's worth noting that acne is something that is less common in countries with a different diet. And so there's something to be said for thinking about factors beyond hormones and genetics that may play a role in the presentation of acne. But the biggest portion of this episode by far was talking about treatment. I think that most clinicians have some degree of comfort with diagnosing acne, especially juvenile or adolescent acne. So really just diving in on, okay, how are we going to treat this? Because it is a huge primary care concern, and it is one that people expect to have addressed in the primary care setting. First line, always to wash the face twice a day, salicylic acid or benzoyl peroxide wash. She did highlight that benzoyl peroxide is a more effective treatment than salicylic acid. And then the base for when you go beyond that for regular treatment is, in most cases, the topical retinoid, which I feel like that is just my perpetual question of, do I do a topical antibiotic or a topical retinoid? And this, she was pretty confident that in most cases, it should be a topical retinoid. And she also provided a few pearls in terms of deciding and counseling on those topical retinoids. So the two common topical retinoids are adapalene and isotretinoin. Again, I hate these names. But of these, she does consider adapalene to be milder, which, given how irritating to the skin the topical retinoids can be, I found very helpful. Because supposing that insurance coverage is the same, there's also the fact that adapalene is over the counter. But supposing you have a choice between them, I generally prefer to start with something that is less likely to be irritating. To that point, she recommended using moisturizer on a regular basis to prevent irritation. She highlighted, of course, by a non-comedogenic one, but that it is not counterproductive to moisturize a face that you are trying to manage acne in. And then she did talk about doing a very slow ramp up of the retinoid. So starting with applying it only like once or twice a week, which is honestly not something that I was doing before listening to this episode. I definitely would tell people, oh, like, take it easy. But the idea of like, oh, use this once a week, especially when people are so anxious to treat their acne, very much stood out to me. But I have been counseling people on it. And I think it's nice because there are so many people that get turned off of retinoids because of the extreme irritation and drying, that if you can help them kind of accommodate it at the outset, may be able to have better success with it.
With that extreme irritation and drying, I'm so tempted to usually say, oh, you can spot treat, or honestly, and let's be real here, spot treat myself. But I'm realizing that in this conversation, if you're reaching for a tretinoin, you should not be spotting, just putting it like all over on little spots in your skin. You should be trying to decrease the whole inflammation across the affected area. So spot treatment is not going to be effective.
Bummer, but yes. But that is something we should counsel on, because again, I think a lot of teenagers like the idea of kind of the pimple patch instant fix. This is what I'm going to do about where the acne is right now. Also, in a counseling, something I didn't know, the adapalene you can use in the morning or at night, but with the tretinoin, and I wrote down other retinoids. I actually don't know if there are other topical ones. There may be, but they should be used specifically at night because the UV will make them inactive. So you're basically ruining your efficacy by having them out in the daylight while using them.
Yeah, that was a myth busted for me that you can use adapalene during the day. I think it's the tretinoin and tazaridine, I think, was the other one.
That's the other one.
Yeah. And I think there's a myth out there that the tretinoin increases, you know, photosensitivity. And while you should always be wearing SPF, that it's nice to know that that's the reason we wear it at night, is that it actually makes the medication ineffective.
Absolutely. And I think to the point on using SPF, and a lot of the moisturizers do come with that SPF, it is okay to use moisturizer at the same time as the adapalene or or any of the retinoids, if that's what's going to get them over the hump to use them consistently, or if that's what's going to allow them to use moisturizer consistently.
All right. So Sydney, we've been using tretinoins consistently. We've been using a benzoyl peroxide or salicylic acid face wash consistently and we're still not seeing the effect that we want, what is the next step? What are some other things in our toolkit?
So I think the next step in many cases, although it really depends on the severity, which we'll get to in a second, but the kind of third of the triad for topicals would be those topical antibiotics. So typically clindamycin, but again, that's just another option that is available.
I thought it was interesting that you can use a benzoyl peroxide wash with the topical antibiotic, and that has an added effect of decreasing the risk for resistance.
I will just say, in the theme of A, practical tips, and B, I am a self-proclaimed skincare girly, and I just like loved this part because I feel like there is a lot of, even for adults, right, there's a lot of these ingredients, and it's really nice to break them all down, and like how to actually use them, you know, like, so she talks about, yes, if your teenagers need to moisturize, which is, I don't know about the two of you, but when I was a teenager and I had acne, I feel like the dogma at that time was to never use a moisturizer and you just need to dry your skin out and that would get rid of your acne. And I'm glad we've been moving away from that. So, you know, she recommends probably ideally lay in the moisturizer if you can, so that you're not mixing it and then having maybe different potencies, or you don't really know how the medication and the moisturizer interact. And then one really interesting point I thought she made was that you should wait for your face to dry before you put on products. That probably applies to the adapalene retinoids, but probably also the antibiotic ointments, just to make them more effective. So that was a nice practical tip, I thought.
Yeah, I appreciate just the plethora of practical tips there. And may we, you know, make all of our patients skincare girlies and boys and humans. Through our counseling around this. So supposing that either you've kind of gone down this topical treatment cascade and aren't seeing a lot of efficacy, or sometimes in more severe cases, she did talk quite a bit about the oral treatments. And our in primary care, our mainstay of oral treatment is going to be oral antibiotics, which interestingly help in part just because they're anti-inflammatory. So it's not just because they're killing the bacteria that trigger the acne, but just the fact that it's anti-inflammatory in general. And her point was, so in terms of the, like, who should use this, in addition to the people who, quote unquote, fail the topicals, she mentioned, first of all, if a kid has scarring, don't wait. And I always want to wait. I always want to say, well, maybe this time it'll respond to the tretinoin. To the retinoid, but it is doing a disservice to a kid that already has scarring to not be more aggressive with management. And also she mentioned that for kids with a truncal presentation with a whole bunch of acne on their back or on their chest, that oral antibiotics are both more practical and sometimes more effective. So in any of the cases that we're using them, the usual go-to is going to be doxycycline or minocycline. She mentioned that for younger children, like under 8, that would be erythromycin. But again, to our point on the age of acne presentation, if I have a kid under 8 with severe acne, I don't think that that's something that I'm managing in a primary care setting. And I think there's an endocrine component as well. Regardless, if you're using one of either doxy or minocycline, she really highlighted that you should probably be using it for a maximum of 3 months at a time and for a maximum of 1 to 2 rounds of it before you say, okay, it's time to involve a dermatologist.
When you're prescribing doxycycline, just a plug for sunscreen one more time, doxycycline itself can be very photosensitizing. So that's something I often counsel patients on.
More plugs for sunscreen.
It's a derm lecture. You know, it's a derm episode. Of course, we're plugging sunscreen.
And then supposing that you are either can't use oral antibiotics or they're not effective or it's just extremely severe acne, kind of the next step that all of us are maybe familiar with, but I don't know a lot of primary care providers prescribe, would be the oral isotretinoin. And she spent some time talking about the iPledge REMS prescription requirements, which I actually didn't know that you technically cannot prescribe this medication if you are not registered with this system because of the severe teratogenicity, that you really need to be cognizant of this severe risk there and demonstrate it by having patients take pregnancy tests at certain intervals, and there's specific conversations that need to occur.
One thing I thought that was cool and just a nice move towards inclusive language was that she says that, I don't know if it's like the actual like site or in the guidelines, that they used to say, you know, male, female, but now they've moved to think of patients in terms of the childbearing potential, because, right, the real risk is of the teratogenicity. And so I thought that was a nice way to break down the gender binary there.
Absolutely. I also appreciated when she was talking about isotretinoin, kind of going through what the actual risks there are, because I think that a lot of people have a lot of ideas of what the risks are that may or may not be true, and a lot of fear of it, but also a lot of impatience to get on it. So the main side effects she talked about, first of all, is just that like everything gets super dry, the eyes, the lips, the nose, and just letting patients know and perhaps doing some anticipatory guidance related to that. And again, if you're in primary care, something to be prepared to counsel patients on if they come in with like conjunctivitis or severe eye dryness is like, oh, well, maybe it has to do with medication. And then the other things to be really aware of are the risk for hepatotoxicity, an increase in triglycerides, and some bone risks. And so just some things that, again, I imagine that the dermatologist will be doing counseling on, but given we may be seeing these patients for follow-up, something to be aware of. And there's obviously baseline and interim labs that are used. There is no known link to mental health outcomes, I think is huge, because that was the thing that I had heard most about as a teen, for sure. I believe that there may be some theoretical associations, but none of it has really been proven. And so, certainly being aware of the mental health of all of your patients is essential regardless. And then, again, this is more for people who are going to prescribe this, but she highlighted that you do need to stop antibiotics 2 weeks before because of the risk for intracranial hypertension with the concurrent use of antibiotics and isotretinoin. And then talking about, for example, the isotretinoin and the oral antibiotics, I think one thing for us to be aware of as primary care providers, and kind of linking back to the conversation we were having at the very beginning, is there are really significant disparities, including along racial and socioeconomic lines in terms of treatment access and outcomes. And she highlighted that patients who are Black and Brown often get fewer prescriptions for the oral antibiotics and for the isotretinoin, and this exists across so many different diagnoses, but just being recognizing the equity implications of the treatments that you are recommending to patients.
I think one of the things she said is that even, you know, one of the bottlenecks is the prescription, but it's also that I think she said that tretinoin is less available in some neighborhoods and some neighborhood pharmacies. So then your patient might need to travel even further if they live in a neighborhood with lower SCS.
Just absolutely wild. And it does make me wonder how many other medications that is the case for. And then a quick kind of rounding out the oral therapy is talking about hormonal therapy. So that would be combined oral contraceptions or spironolactone. Certainly she said like these are reasonable things to use in some cases. They do take longer to work than certainly the oral antibiotics or the isotretinoin. And then in terms of recognizing who this may work best for, patients that have a lower facial pattern to their acne is more likely to be hormonally mediated, which I found fascinating and definitely didn't know before. And so I don't know that I would say only those patients should get on those medications, but maybe thinking about, oh, these are people who would be likely to benefit from starting one of those treatments if they are interested and feel comfortable with the risks benefits there. And then kind of the last big thing I had kind of taken away from this is just like see people back to check in. I think because acne is so common, we often are like, oh, you're fine. Here, I gave you a treatment. Go on with your life. But the truth is, just like pruritus can be debilitating, acne, especially in its more severe forms, can be very, very disturbing and disruptive to kids in their lives. And I feel like I definitely have been guilty of not doing the proper follow-up until we next see them for a physical. And it's like, oh, well, really, it's been, you know, 8 months in this time frame. We should have started you on an oral antibiotic. We should have talked about a next step. So I have been trying to be more cognizant of that as well.
I love it. Well, thank you both so much. I think we've really smoothed out three rough skin conditions. That was really not well done. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for taking the time.
With that, this has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
For kids. Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Foods Formula Feeds newsletter on our website and at www.thecribsiders.com.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our showrunner, Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media guru, Denise Cruz, on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. Who's put this in here? I've been, quote, skincare girly, Angela Wisang.
I've been Sydney Engel.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew using an AI device to make him sound more like Brian Ward. Thank you and good night.